Well, I don't think it is always wrong.
Ah,
he mused, his amber eyes glittering in the same wry smile.
Well, I must tell you that it is always wrong. This will become clear later in our discussion. For now, concentrate on the type of killing that you do think is wrong, and tell me why it is wrong.
Yeah, well, it's the unlawful taking of a life.
By whose law?
Society's law, the law of the land, I offered, sensing that the philosophical ground was slipping away beneath me.
Who makes this law?
He asked gently. Politicians pass laws. Criminal laws are inherited from civilization. The laws against unlawful killing go all the way back. Maybe all the way back to the cave.
And why was killing wrong for them?
You mean, well, I'd say because there's only one life. You only get one shot at it, and to take it away is a terrible thing.
A lightning storm is a terrible thing. Does that make it wrong or evil?
No, of course not, I replied more irritably. Look, I don't know why we need to know what's behind the laws against killing. We have one life, and if you take a life without a good reason, you do something wrong.
Yes, he said patiently. But why is it wrong?
It just is, that's all.
This is the point we all reach,
Kader concluded, more serious in his tone. He put his hand on my wrist as it rested on the arm of my chair beside him, and he tapped out the important points with his fingers.
If you ask people why killing or any other crime is wrong, they will tell you that it is against the law, or that the Bible, or the Upanishads, or the Quran, or the Buddha's Eightfold Path, or their parents, or some other authority tells them it is wrong. But they don't know why it is wrong. It may be true what they say, but they don't know why it is true. In order to know about any act or intention or consequence, we must first ask two questions. One, what would happen if everyone did this thing? Two, would this help or hinder the movement toward complexity?
He paused as a servant entered with Nazir. The servant brought sweet black Suleimani chai in long glasses and a variety of irresistible sweets on a silver tray. Nazir brought a questioning glance for Kader Bai and a scowl of unmitigated contempt for me. Kader thanked him and the servant, and they left us alone once more.
In the case of killing,
Kader continued, after he'd sipped the tea through a cube of white sugar.
What would happen if everyone killed people? Would that help or hinder? Tell me.
Obviously, if everyone killed people, we would wipe each other out, so that wouldn't help.
Yes. We human beings are the most complex arrangement of matter that we know of. But we are not the last achievement of the universe. We too will develop and change with the rest of the universe. But if we kill indiscriminately, we will not get there. We will wipe out our species and all the development that led us across millions of years, billions of years, will be lost. The same can be said for stealing. What would happen if everyone stole things? Would that help us, or would it hinder us?
Yeah, I get the point. If everyone was stealing off everyone else, we'd be so paranoid and we'd waste so much time and money on it that it would slow us down and we'd never get
to the ultimate complexity,
he completed the thought for me.
This is why killing and stealing are wrong. Not because a book tells us they're wrong, or a law tells us they are wrong, or a spiritual guide tells us they are wrong. But because if everyone did them, we would not move toward the ultimate complexity that is God with the rest of the universe. And the opposite of these is also true. Why is love good? Well, what would happen if everyone loved everyone else? Would that help us, or would it hold us back? It would help, I agreed, laughing from within the trap he'd set for me. Yes. In fact, such universal love would greatly accelerate the movement toward God. Love is good. Friendship is good. Loyalty is good. Freedom is good. Honesty is good. We knew that these things were good before. We have always known this in our hearts. And all the great teachers have always told us this. But now, with this definition of good and evil, we can see why they are good. Just as we can see why stealing and lying and killing are evil. But sometimes, I protested, you know, what about self-defense? What about killing to defend yourself? Yes, a good point, Lynn. I want you to imagine a scene for me. You are standing in a room with a desk in front of you. On the other side of the room is your mother. A vicious man holds a knife to the throat of your mother. The man will kill your mother. On the table in front of you, there is a button. If you press it, the man will die. If you do not, he will kill your mother. These are the only possible outcomes. If you do nothing, your mother dies. If you press the button, the man dies and your mother is saved. What would you do? The guy's history, I answered without hesitation. Just so, he sighed, perhaps wishing that I'd wrestled with the decision a little longer before pressing the button. And if you did this, if you saved your mother from this vicious killer, would you be doing the wrong thing or the right thing? The right thing, I said, just as swiftly. No, Lynn, I'm afraid not, he frowned. We have just seen that in the terms of this new objective definition of good and evil, killing is always wrong, because if everyone did it, we would not move toward God, the ultimate complexity with the rest of the universe. So it is wrong to kill. But your reasons were good. So, therefore, the truth of this decision is that you did the wrong thing for the right reasons. As I rode the wind, a week after Kader's little lecture on ethics, weaving the bike through ancient modern traffic beneath a darkening, portentous tumble of clouds, those words echoed in my mind. The wrong thing for the right reasons. I rode on, and even when I stopped thinking about Kader's lesson, those words still murmured in the little grey daydream space where memory meets inspiration. I know now that the words were like a mantra, and that my instinct, fate's whisper in the dark, was trying to warn me of something by repeating them. The wrong thing for the right reasons. But on that day, an hour after Didier's confession, I let the murmured warnings fade. Right or wrong, I didn't want to think about the reasons. Not my reasons for doing what I did, or Kader's, or anyone's. I enjoyed the discussions of good and evil, but only as a game, as an entertainment. I didn't really want the truth. I was sick of truth, especially my own truth, and I couldn't face it. So the thoughts and premonitions echoed and then whipped past me into the coils of humid wind. And by the time I swept into the last curve of coast, near the Sea Rock Hotel, my mind was as clear as the broad horizon, clamped upon the limit of a dark and tremulous sea. The Sea Rock, which was as luxurious and opulently serviced as the other five-star hotels in Bombay, offered the special attraction that it was literally built upon the sea rocks at Juhu. From all its major restaurants, bars, and 100 other windows, the Sea Rock scanned the endlessly shifting peaks and furrows of the Arabian Sea. The hotel also offered one of the best and most comprehensively eclectic smorgasbord lunches in the city. I was hungry, and glad to see that Lisa was waiting for me in the foyer. She wore a starched sky blue shirt with the collar turned up, and sky blue culottes. Her blonde hair was wound into the praying fingers of a French braid. She'd been clean, off heroin, for more than a year. She looked tanned and healthy and confident.
Hi, Lin, she smiled, greeting me with a kiss on the cheek. You're just in time.
Great, I'm starving.
No, I mean you're just in time to meet Kalpana. Just a minute, here she comes now. A young woman with a fashionably Western short haircut, hipster jeans, and a tight red T-shirt approached us. She wore a stopwatch around her neck on a lanyard and carried a clipboard. She was about 26 years old.
Hello, I said when Lisa introduced us. Is that your rig outside? The broadcast vans and all the cables? Are you shooting a movie?
Supposed to be, yeah, she replied, in the exaggerated vowels of the Bombay accent that I loved and found myself unconsciously imitating. The director has gone off somewhere with one of our dancers. It's meant to be a secret, yeah, but the whole damn set is talking about it. We've got a 45-minute break, although, mind you, that's about 10 times as long as our guy will need, from what all I'm told about his prowess.
Okay, I suggested, smacking my hands together. That gives us time for lunch.
Fuck lunch. Let's get stoned first, yeah, Kalpana demurred. Have you got any hash?
Yeah, I shrugged. Sure.
Did you bring a car?
I'm on a bullet.
Okay, let's use my car. It's in the car park.
We left the hotel and sat in her new Fiat to smoke. While I prepared the joint, she told me that she was an assistant to the producer of that and several other films. One of her duties was to oversee the casting of minor roles in the films. She'd subcontracted the task to a casting agent, but he was experiencing difficulty in finding foreigners to fill the small, non-speaking decorative roles. Kalpana got talking about this at dinner last week, Lisa summed up when Kalpana began to smoke. She told me that her guys couldn't find foreigners to play the parts in the movies. You know, the people at a disco or a party scene or, like, British people in the time of the British Raj and like that. So, I thought of you.
Uh-huh.
It would be a great help if you could get the Goras for me when we need them,
Kalpana said, offering me what seemed to be a well-practiced leer. Practiced or not, it was damned effective.
We provide a cab to bring them to the shoot and take them home again. We give them a full lunch during the break, and we pay about 2,000 rupees a day per person. We pay that to you, plus a bonus commission per head. What you pay them, well, it's up to you. Most of them are happy to do it for nothing and are real surprised, you know, when they find out we actually pay them to be in the movies.
What do you say? Lisa asked me, her eyes gleaming through the rose filter of her stone. I'm interested. My mind was trawling through the possible lateral benefits in the arrangement. Some of them were obvious. The movie makers were a fairly affluent crowd of frequent flyers, who might need black market dollars and documents from time to time. It was clear to me as well that the casting job was important to Lisa. On its own, that was reason enough for me to get involved. I liked her, and I was glad that she wanted to like me.
Good,
Kalpana concluded, opening the door and stepping out to the car park. We walked back to the hotel foyer, each of us with sunglasses clamped to our eyes. We shook hands at the same spot where we'd met half an hour before.
Have your lunch, she said. I'll go back to the set. We're in the ballroom. When you're all done, follow the cables and you'll find me. I'll introduce you to the guys and you can start right away. We need a few foreigners for tomorrow's shoot here. 2 guys and 2 girls, yeah. Blonde, Sweden types, if you can find them. Hey, that was Kashmiri hash, no? We'll get along just fine, Lin, you and me. Ciao. Ciao, baby.
In the restaurant, Lisa and I heaped our plates high and sat facing the sea to eat. Kalpana's okay, she said between mouthfuls. She's sarcastic as all hell sometimes, and she's a real ambitious girl. Don't make any mistake about that. But she's a straight talker and a real friend. When she told me about the casting job, I thought about you. I thought you might be able to make something out of it.
Thanks, I said, meeting her eye and trying to read her. I appreciate the thought.
You want to be partners in it with me?
Yes, she answered quickly. I was hoping you'd want to.
We could work it out together, I suggested. I don't think I'll have any trouble getting foreigners to work in the movies, but I don't really want to do the rest of it. You could do that part if you like. You could organize picking them up, looking after them on the set, and making the payments and all that. I'll talk them into it, and you take it from there. I'd be glad to work with you, if you're interested. She smiled. It was a good smile, the kind you like to keep.
I'd love to do it, she gushed,
flushing pink with embarrassment under her tan.
I really need to do something, Lynn, and I think I'm ready. When Kalpana ran this casting thing by me, I wanted to jump at it, but I was too nervous to take it on alone. Thanks.
Don't mention it. How's it going with you and Abdullah?
She mumbled, finishing a mouthful of food. I'm not working, if you know what I mean. So that's something. I'm not working at the palace, and I'm not using. He gave me money. A lot of money. I don't know where he got it. I don't really care. It's more money than I've ever seen in one bundle before in my whole life. It's in this case, this metal case. He gave it to me and asked me to look after it for him, and to spend it whenever I needed. It was real spooky, kind of like, I don't know, like his last will and testament or something.
I raised one eyebrow unconsciously in a quizzical expression. She caught the look, reflected a moment, and then responded.
I trust you, Lynn. You're the only guy in this city I do trust. Funny thing is, Abdullah's the guy gave me the money and all. And I think I love him in a kind of insane way. But I don't trust him. Is that a horrible thing to say about the guy you live with?
No.
Do you trust him?
With my life.
Why?
I hesitated. And then the words didn't come. We finished our meal and sat back from the table, looking at the sea. We've been through some things, I said after a while. But it's not just that. I trusted him before we did any of that. I don't know what it is. A man trusts another man when he sees enough of himself in him, I guess. Or maybe when he sees the things he wishes he had in himself. We were silent for a time, each of us troubled, and stubbornly tempting fate in our own ways. Are you ready? I asked her. She nodded in reply. Let's go to the movies. We followed the black vines of relay cables from the generator vans outside the hotel. They led us through a side entrance and past a procession of bustling assistants to the banquet room, which had been hired as a set. The room was filled with people, powerful lights, dazzling reflector panels, cameras and equipment. Seconds after we entered, someone shouted, "Quiet, please!" And then a riotous musical number began. Hindi movies aren't to everyone's taste. Some foreigners I dealt with had told me that they loathed the kaleidoscopic turmoil of musical numbers, bursting stochastically between weeping mothers, sighing infatuates, and brawling villains. I understood what they meant, but I didn't agree with them. A year before, Johnny Sagar had told me that in former lives I must have been at least 6 different Indian personalities. I'd taken it as a high compliment, but it wasn't until I saw my first Bollywood movie shoot that I knew at last and exactly what he'd meant. I loved the singing, the dancing and the music with the whole of my heart from the very first instant. The producers had hired a 2,000-watt amplifier. The music crashed through the banquet room and rattled into our bones. The colours were from a tropical sea. The million lights were as dazzling as a sunstruck lake. The faces were as beautiful as those carved on temple walls. The dancing was a frenzy of excited, exuberant lasciviousness and ancient classical skills. And the whole improbably coherent expression of love and life, drama and comedy, was articulated in the delicate, unfurled elegance of a graceful hand or the wink of a seductive eye. For an hour we watched as the dance number was rehearsed and refined and finally recorded on film. During a break after that, Kalpana introduced me to Cliff D'Souza and Chandra Mehta, two of the four producers of the film. D'Souza was a tall, curly-haired, 30-year-old Goan, with a disarming grin and a loping walk. Chandra Mehta was closer to 40. He was overweight, but comfortable with it. One of those big men who expand to fit a big idea of themselves. I liked both men, and although they were too busy to talk for long, that first meeting was cordial and communicative. I offered Lisa a lift back to town, but she'd arranged to ride with Kalpana, and she chose to wait. I gave her the phone number at my new apartment, telling her to call if she needed me. On my way out through the foyer, I saw Kavita Singh also leaving the hotel. We'd both been so busy in recent months, she with writing about crimes and me with committing them, that we hadn't seen one another for many weeks. "Kavita!" I called out, running forward to catch her. "Just the woman I wanted to see. The number one reporter on Bombay's number one newspaper. How are you?" "You look great." She was dressed in a silk pantsuit. It was the colour of bleached bone. She carried a linen handbag in the same colour. The single-breasted jacket descended to a deep décolletage, and it was obvious that she was wearing nothing under the jacket. "Oh, come off it," she snapped, grinning and embarrassed. "This is my dress-to-kill outfit. I had to interview Vasant Lal. I just came out of there." "You're moving in powerful circles," I said, recalling photos of the populist politician. His incitements to communal violence had resulted in rioting, arson and murder. Each time I saw him on television or read one of his bigoted speeches in the newspaper, he made me think of the brutal madman who called himself Shapna, a legal, political version of the psychopathic killer. "It was a snake pit up there in his suite, I tell you, Baba. But I got my interview. He has a weakness for big tits." She whipped a finger into my face. "Don't say anything." "Hey," I pacified her, raising both hands and wagging my head. "I'm saying nothing at all, yeah. Absolutely nothing. I'm looking, mind you, and I wish I had three eyes, but I'm saying nothing at all."
"You bastard," she hissed, laughing through gritted teeth. "Ah, shit, what's happening to the world, man, when one of the most important guys in the city won't talk to you, but will give a two-hour interview to your tits? Men are such sick fuckers, don't you think?"
"You got me there, Kavita," I sighed.
"Fucking pigs, yeah."
"Can't argue with that. When you're right, you're right." She eyed me suspiciously.
"What are you being so damned agreeable about, Lin?"
"Listen, where are you going?"
"What?
Where are you going, right now, I mean?"
"I was going to take a cab back to town. I'm living near Flora Fountain now."
"How about I give you a lift on my bike? I want to talk to you. I want you to help me with a problem." Kavita didn't know me well. Her eyes were the colour of bark on a cinnamon tree, flecked with golden sparks. She looked me up and down with those eyes, and the forensic examination left her somewhere short of inspired reassurance.
"What kind of a problem?" she asked.
"It involves a murder," I replied. "And I want you to make it a page one story. I'll tell you all about it at your place. And on the way, you can tell me about Vasant Lal. You'll have to shout on the back of the bike, so that'll help you to get it out of your system, nah?" Some 40 minutes later, we sat together on her fourth floor walk-up apartment on the edge of the fort area near Flora Fountain. It was a tiny apartment with a fold-out bed, a rudimentary kitchen, and 100 noisy neighbours. It boasted a superb bathroom, however, large enough to hold a washing machine and dryer without crowding. There was also a balcony enclosed in antique wrought iron that looked out onto the wide, busy square around the fountain. "His name is Anand Rao," I told her, sipping the strong espresso coffee she'd prepared for me. "He shared a hut in the slum with a guy named Rashid. They were my neighbours when I lived there. Then Rashid's wife and her sister came to stay, from the village in Rajasthan. Anand moved out of the hut to leave room for Rashid and the sisters."
"Hang on," Kavita interrupted. "I better get this down."
She stood up and walked to a wide, cluttered desk, where she gathered up a pad, pen, and cassette recorder. She'd changed out of her pantsuit and wore loose harem pants and a singlet. Watching her walk, following her quick, purposeful, graceful movements, I realized for the first time just how beautiful she was. When she returned and set up the recorder, tucking her legs beneath her on the armchair as she prepared to write, she caught me staring at her.
"What?" she asked.
"Nothing," I smiled. "Okay, so Anand Rao got to meet Rashid's wife and her sister. He got to like them. They were shy, but they were friendly, happy and kind. I think now, reading between the lines, that Anand got a little sweet on the sister. Anyway, one day Rashid tells his wife that the only way they can set themselves up in the little shop that they want is if he sells his kidney, one of his kidneys, at this private hospital he knows about. She argues against this, but he finally convinces her that it's their only chance. Well, he comes back from the hospital and he tells her he's got good news and bad news. The good news is that they definitely want a kidney. The bad news is that they don't want a man's kidney. They want a woman's kidney."
"Okay," Kavita sighed, shaking her head.
"Yeah, the guy was a prince. Anyway, his wife balks at this, understandably, but Rashid convinces her, and she goes off to have the operation."
"Do you know where this took place?" Kavita asked.
"Yeah, Anand Rao checked into it all and told Kasim Ali, the head man in the slum. He's got the details. So anyway, Anand Rao hears about this when Rashid's wife returns from the hospital, and he's furious. He knows Rashid well. They shared the hut together for 2 years, remember? And he knows that Rashid is a con man. He has it out with Rashid, but it comes to nothing. Rashid gets all indignant. He spills kerosene on himself and tells Anand Rao to light it if he doesn't trust him, and if he thinks he's such a bad guy. Anand just warns him to look after the women and leaves it at that."
"When did this happen?"
"The operation was 6 months ago. Well, the next thing is, Rashid tells his wife that he's been down to the hospital 20 times to sell his own kidney, but they don't want it. He tells her the money they got for her kidney was only half as much as they need to buy their business. He tells her that they still want women's kidneys, and he starts working on her to sell her sister's kidney. The wife is against it, but Rashid works on the young sister, telling her that if she doesn't sell her kidney, then the wife would have sold her kidney for nothing. Finally, the women give in. Rashid packs the younger sister off to the hospital, and she returns minus one of her kidneys."
"This is some guy," Kavita muttered.
"Yeah, well, I never liked him. He was one of those guys who smile as a tactic, you know, and not because they actually feel anything worth smiling about. Kind of like the way a chimpanzee smiles."
"And what happened? He took off with the money, I suppose."
"Yeah. Rashid took the money and ran. The two sisters were devastated. Their health deteriorated. They went downhill fast. They ended up in hospital. First one and then the other. They both fell into a coma. Lying together in their hospital beds, they were pronounced dead within minutes of each other. Anand was there with a few others from the slum. He stayed long enough to see the sheets pulled over their faces. Then he ran out of the hospital. He went out of his mind with anger and guilt, I suppose. He went looking for Rashid. He knew every one of Rashid's drinking dives. When he tracked him down, Rashid was lying in a rubbish pit sleeping off a binge. He'd paid some kids to keep the rats off his drunken body. Anand chased the kids off and sat down beside Rashid and listened to him snore. Then he cut his throat and waited there until the blood stopped flowing."
"Pretty messy,"
Kavita muttered, not looking up from her pad. "It was. It is. Anand gave himself up and made a full confession. He's been charged with murder."
"And you want me to..."
"I want you to make it a front-page story. I want you to build some kind of popular movement around him, so that if they do convict him, which they will for sure, they'll have to go a little easy on him. I want him to have support while he's in prison. And I want to keep his prison time down to as little as possible.
That's a lot of I want.
I know.
Well, she frowned, it's an interesting story, but I've got to tell you, Lynn, we get too many stories like this every day. Wife burning, dowry murders, child prostitution, slavery, female infanticide. It's a war against women in India, Lynn. It's a fight to the death, and mostly it's the women dying. I want to help your guy, but I don't see this as page one, yeah? And anyway, I don't have any pull with page one. I'm new there myself, don't forget.
There's more, I pressed her. The kicker in the story is that the sisters didn't die. Half an hour after they were pronounced dead, Rashid's wife stirred beneath the sheet. A few minutes later, her sister moved and groaned. They're alive and well today. Their hut in the slum has become a kind of shrine. People come from all over the city to see the miracle sisters who returned from the dead. It's the best thing that's ever happened to the businesses in the slum. They're doing a roaring trade with the pilgrims. And the sisters are richer than they could ever have dreamed. People are throwing money at them, a rupee or two at a time, and it's really adding up. The sisters have set up a charity for abandoned wives. And I think their story, back from the dead, you know, is enough to jump this to page one.
Array, yeah, Baba, Kavita yelped. Okay, first you have to get me together with the women. They're the key to this. Then I have to interview Anand Rao in prison.
I'll take you there.
No, she insisted. I have to speak to him alone. I don't want him prompted by you or responding to you. I have to see how he'll hold up on his own. If we're going to build a campaign around him, he'll have to stand alone, yeah? But you can speak to him first and prepare the way before my interview. I'll try to get to see him in the next 2 or 3 weeks. We've got a lot to do.
For 2 hours we discussed the campaign, and I answered her many questions. I left her in a happy, enthusiastic whirl of pressure and purpose. I rode straight out to Nariman Point and bought a sizzling meal from one of the fast food vans parked on the beach. But my appetite wasn't as good as I'd thought, and I ate less than half. I went down to the rocks to rinse my hands in the seawater, within sight of the spot where Abdullah had introduced himself to me 3 years before. Kader's words floated on the swift, shallow stream of my thoughts once again. The wrong thing for the right reasons. I thought of Anand Rao in Arthur Road Prison, in the big dormitory room with the overseers and the body lice. I shivered the thought off into the breeze. Kavita had asked me why the Anand Rao case was so important to me. I didn't tell her that he'd come to me before he committed the murder. Only a week before he cut Rashid's throat. I didn't tell her that I'd brushed him off and insulted him, demeaning his dilemma with an offer of money. I smudged an answer to her question and let her think that I was just trying to help a friend, just trying to do the right thing. Kader Bhai once said that every virtuous act is inspired by a dark secret. It mightn't be true of everyone, but it was true enough about me. The little good that I've done in the world has always dragged behind it a shadow of dark inspiration. What I do know now, and didn't know then, is that in the long run, motive matters more with good deeds than it does with bad. When all the guilt and shame for the bad we've done have run their course, it's the good we did that can save us. But then, when salvation speaks, the secrets we kept and the motives we concealed creep from their shadows. They cling to us, those dark motives for our good deeds. Redemption's climb is steepest if the good we did is soiled with secret shame. But I didn't know that then. I washed my hands in the cold, uncaring sea, and my conscience was as silent and remote as the mute, unreachable stars.
Chapter 27. Used passports, known as books to us, the counterfeiters and smugglers who traded in them,
had to be checked before they could be sold or used by black marketeers. It was always possible that the junkies, runaways or indigent foreigners who'd sold their passports to our agents were wanted for some serious offence in their own or some other country. More than a few smugglers had been caught out in that way. They'd bought passports, changed them to suit, and set out on a mission, only to find themselves arrested at a foreign airport because the original owners were wanted for murder or robbery or different smuggling charges. To ensure the satisfaction of our customers and the safety of our couriers, Abdul Ghani subjected every new passport that he bought or stole to two levels of scrutiny. A customs officer with access to a computer at Bombay's International Airport provided the first filter. At a time and place of his choosing, the officer was given a sheet bearing the country of origin, passport number, and original name on each passport to be checked. A day or two later, he returned the sheet, with a line drawn through those that were flagged in his computer. Some of the passports were flagged because international arrest warrants had been issued for the original owners. Some passports were flagged because suspicion attached itself to the owner, a hint of involvement in the illegal drugs or arms trade, or some political connection that made security services uneasy. Whatever the reason, flagged passports couldn't be sold on the black market or used by Ghani's couriers. Flagged books still had their uses. It was possible to cannibalize them by pulling apart the stitching to furnish fresh pages for other, usable books. There were also other uses within India. Although foreigners had to show their passports for C-form entries when they registered at hotels, every city had its share of places that weren't fastidiously precise about the resemblance, or lack of it, between a passport and its bearer. For those hotels, any passport did the job. Although unable to travel out of India with such a flagged passport, a man or woman could use one to move around within the country safely and satisfy the minimum legal requirements that an obliging hotel manager had to observe. Unflagged books that did pass the customs check were sent through a second filter at airline offices. All the major airlines kept their own lists of hot or flagged passports. Inclusion of a passport name and number on the list was prompted by anything from a bad credit rating or fraudulent dealings with an airline to any incident involving violent behaviour as a passenger on a plane. Naturally enough, when smugglers were going about the business of their crimes, they were eager to avoid any but the most superficial and routine attention from airline staff, customs personnel, or police. A passport that was flagged for any reason was useless to them. Abdul Ghani's agents at the offices of most of the major airlines in Bombay checked the numbers and names of the passports we'd acquired and reported those that were flagged. The clean books that passed through both filters, a little less than half of all those obtained, were sold or used by Kader's couriers. The clients who bought Ghani's illegal passports fell into three main categories. The first were economic refugees, people forced from their land by famine or driven to seek a better life in a new country. There were Turks wanting to work in Germany, Albanians wanting to work in Italy, Algerians wanting to work in France, and people from several Asian countries who wanted to work in Canada and the United States. A family, a group of families, and sometimes a whole village community pooled their meager earnings to purchase one of Abdul's passports and send a favored son to one of the promised lands. Once there, he worked to repay their loan and eventually buy new passports for other young men and women. The passport sold for anything between $5,000 and $25,000. Kader Bhai's network issued about 100 of those poverty passports every year, and his annual profit, after all the overheads, was more than $1 million. Political refugees made up the second category of clients. The upheavals that sent those people into exile were often violent. They were victims of wars and of conflicts based upon community, religion, or ethnicity. Sometimes the upheaval was legislated. Thousands of Hong Kong residents who weren't recognised as British citizens became potential clients with the stroke of a pen when Britain decided in 1984 to return its colonial possession to China in a 13-year resolution of sovereignty. Around the world, at any one time, there were 20 million refugees living in camps and safe havens. Abdul Ghani's passport agents were never idle.
A new book cost those people anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000. The higher price was determined by the greater risks involved in smuggling into war zones, and the greater demand to escape from them. The third group of clients for Abdul's illegal books was criminals. Occasionally, those criminals were men like me, thieves, smugglers, contract killers, who needed a new identity to stay one step ahead of the police. For the most part, however, Abdul Ghani's special clients were the kind of men who were more likely to build and fill prisons than to serve time in them. They were dictators, military coup leaders, secret policemen, and bureaucrats from corrupt regimes forced to take flight when their crimes were uncovered or the regime fell. One Ugandan fugitive, a man I dealt with personally, had stolen more than $1 million, allocated by international monetary agencies for essential service constructions, including a children's hospital. The hospital was never built. Instead, the sick, injured, and dying children were transported to a remote camp and left to fend for themselves. At a meeting that I set up in Kinshasa, Zaire, the man paid me $200,000 for two books, a perfect unblemished Swiss passport and a virgin original Canadian passport, and travelled safely to Venezuela. Abdul's agents in South America, Asia, and Africa established contact with embezzlers, torturers, mandarins, and martinets who'd supported fallen tyrannies. Dealing with them gave me more angry shame than anything else I ever did in Kadarbai's service. In the young life I'd known as a free man, I was a dedicated writer of newspaper articles and pamphlets. I'd spent years researching and exposing the crimes and violations perpetrated by such men. I'd put my body on the line, supporting their victims in 100 violent protest clashes with the police. And I still felt some of the old hatred and a choking sense of outrage when I dealt with them. But that life I'd known was gone. The revolutionary social activist had lost his ideals in heroin and crime. And I too was a wanted man. I too had a price on my head. I was a gangster, and I lived from one day to the next with only Kader's mafia council standing between me and prison torture. So I played my part in Ghani's network, helping mass murderers to escape from the death sentences they'd passed on so many others and had finally earned from their countrymen in return. But I didn't like it, and I didn't like them, and I let them know it. I drove them to the wall on every deal, taking a little solace from the rage I provoked in them. And they haggled infuriatingly, those human rights abusers, self-righteously indignant about spending the money they'd gouged from people's mouths. But in the end, they all caved in and agreed to our terms. In the end, they paid well. No one else in Kadarbai's network seemed to share my sense of outrage or my shame. There's probably no single group of citizens who are more cynical about politics and politicians than professional criminals. In their view, all politicians are ruthless and corrupt, and all political systems favour the powerful rich over the defenceless poor. And in time, and in a sense, I began to share their view, because I knew the experience in which it was grounded. Prison had given us an intimate acquaintance with human rights violations, and every day the courts confirmed what we'd learned about the law. The rich in any country and any system always got the best justice money could buy. On the other hand, the criminals in Kader's network displayed a kind of egalitarianism that would have filled communists and Gnostic Christians with admiring envy. They didn't care about the colour, creed, race, or political orientation of clients, and they didn't judge them when asking about their past. Every life, no matter how innocent or evil, reduced to only one question. How bad do you need the book? The answer established the going rate, and every customer who had the money to pay it was born again, with no history and no sin, in the moment of the deal. No client was better than any other, and none was worse. Abdul Ghani, propelled by the purest amoral spirit of market forces,
serviced the needs of generals, mercenaries, misappropriators of public funds, and murderous interrogators without a hint of censure or dismay. Their freedom brought in about $2 million each year in clear profit. But although he wasn't ethically squeamish about the source of the income, or receiving it, Abdul Ghani was religiously superstitious about spending it. Every dollar earned in saving that poisonous clientele went to a refugee rescue program that Kadarbai had established for Iranians and Afghans displaced by war. Every passport bought by one of the warlords or their apparatchiks bought 50 more books, identity cards, or travel documents for Iranian and Afghan refugees. Thus, in one of those psychic labyrinths that fate likes to build around greed and fear, the high prices paid by tyrants rescued many of those made wretched by tyranny. Krishna and Vilu taught me everything they knew about the passport business, and in time I began to experiment, creating new identities for myself with American, Canadian, Dutch, German, and British books. My work wasn't as good as theirs, and never would be. Good forgers are artists. Their artistic vision must encompass the deliberate creative smudge that gives each page its counterfeit authenticity, no less than the accuracy of altered or manufactured details. Each page that they create is a miniature painting, a tiny expression of their art. The precise angle of one slightly skewed stamp, or the casual blurring of another, are as significant to those small canvases as the shape, position, and colour of a fallen rose might be in a grand master's portrait. The effect, no matter how skillfully achieved, is always born in the artist's intuition, and intuition can't be taught. My skills, instead, found expression in the stories that had to be invented for every newly created book. There were often gaps of months, or even years, in the record of travel contained within the books that we got from foreigners. Some had overstayed their visas, and that lapse had to be expunged from the book before it could be used. Stamping an exit from Bombay Airport before the last visa's expiry date, as if the passport holder had left the country within the life of the visa, I then set about establishing a history of movement from one country to another for every book, using the bank of exit and entry stamps that Vilu had created. Little by little, I brought each book up to date, and finally supplied it with a new visa for India and an entry stamp at Bombay Airport. The chain of entries and exits that linked that lapsed time was always carefully plotted. Krishna and Vilu had a library of logbooks from the major airlines, listing all of the flights in and out of Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Americas, with their departure dates and arrival times. If we put a stamp into a British book stating that the holder had arrived in Athens on July the 4th, say, we were sure that a British Airways flight had connected at Athens Airport on that day. In that way, every book had a personal history of travel and experience, backed up by logs, timetables, and weather details, which gave the new bearer a credible personal history. My first test of the passports I'd forged for myself was on the domestic transfer route, known as the Double Shuffle. Thousands of Iranian and Afghan refugees in Bombay tried to find asylum in Canada, Australia, the United States, and elsewhere, but the governments of those countries refused to consider them. If they could land there, in those Western countries, they could declare themselves to be asylum seekers and submit to the processes of assessment that determined the merit of their applications. Because they were political refugees and genuine asylum seekers, the applications they launched within the nominated country were often successful. The trick was to get them into Canada or Sweden or some other country of choice in the first place. The double shuffle was the system we used. When Iranians or Afghans in Bombay tried to buy tickets to the asylum countries, they were required to show current visas for those countries. But they couldn't obtain the visas legally, and false visas were impractical because they were immediately checked against the consular register. So I purchased a ticket to Canada or Sweden with a false visa. As a Gora, a well-dressed foreigner of European appearance, I was never subjected to anything but a cursory examination. No one ever bothered to check if my visa was genuine. The refugee I was helping then purchased a ticket for the domestic leg, from Bombay to Delhi, on the same plane. As we boarded the plane, we received boarding passes. Mine was the green international boarding pass, and his was the red domestic pass. Once in the air, we swapped our boarding passes. At Delhi Airport, only those with green international boarding passes were permitted to remain on board. Clutching my domestic pass, I got down at Delhi and left the refugee to continue on to Canada or Sweden, or whatever the destination of the flight we'd chosen. Upon arrival, he would declare himself to be an asylum seeker, and the process of his recognition would begin. In Delhi, I would spend the night at a 5-star and then purchase another ticket to repeat the process, the double shuffle, with another refugee on the Delhi to Bombay route. The system worked. In those years, we smuggled hundreds of Iranian and Afghan doctors, engineers, architects, academics, and poets into their nominated countries. I received $3,000 for a double shuffle, and for a while, I did 2 doubles per month. After 3 months of internal flights from Bombay to Delhi, Calcutta, Madras, and back, Abdul Ghani sent me on my first international courier run. I carried a package of 10 passports to Zaire. Using photographs of the recipients, sent from Kinshasa, the capital, Krishna and Vilu had worked the passports into perfect counterfeit books. After sealing them in plastic, I taped them to my body under 3 layers of clothing and flew into the steaming, well-armed mayhem of Kinshasa's international airport. It was a dangerous mission. At that time, Zaire was a neutral no-man's land between the bloody proxy wars that raged in Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, Sudan, Uganda, and the Congo. It was the personal fiefdom of the conspicuously insane dictator Mobutu, and a percentage of the profit from every crime in the kingdom slithered into his pocket. Mobutu was a darling of the Western powers because he bought every costly killing weapon they offered to sell him. If it mattered to them that Mobutu turned the weapons on trade unionists and other social reformers in his own country, they never expressed the concern publicly. Those governments hosted the dictator in lavish style at royal and presidential receptions, while hundreds of men and women were being tortured to death in his prisons. The same governments were hunting me through the International Police Agency, Interpol, and there was no doubt in my mind that their ally would have taken great pleasure in finishing me off for them, as a bonus, so to speak, if the passport mission had gone wrong and I'd found myself arrested in his capital city. Still, I liked the wildness of Kinshasa, a city that thrived as an open marketplace for the trade in every kind of contraband, from gold and drugs to rocket launchers. The city was full of mercenaries, fugitives, criminals, black market profiteers, and wide-eyed, bare-knuckled opportunists from all over Africa. I felt at home there, and I would have stayed longer, but within 72 hours I delivered the books and accepted $120,000 in payment. It was Kaderbai's money. I was anxious to hand it over. I jumped the first flight back to Bombay and reported to Abdul Ghani. What I gained from the mission was $10,000 American, field experience, and an introduction to the African branch of Ghani's network. The network and the experience were worth the risk, it seemed to me then. The money was unimportant. I would have done the job for half the wage or less. I knew that most of the human lives in Bombay came and went much cheaper. More than that, there was the danger. For some people, danger's a kind of drug or even an aphrodisiac. For me, living as a fugitive, living every day and every night of my life with the fear of being killed or captured, danger was something else. Danger was one of the lances I used to kill the dragon of stress. It helped me to sleep. When I went to dangerous places and I did dangerous things, a rush of new and different fear swept over me. That new fear covered the dread that too often worried me awake. When the job was done, and the new fear subsided and passed away. I drowned in an exhausted peace. And I wasn't alone in that hunger for dangerous work. In the course of the job, I met other agents, smugglers and mercenaries, whose excited eyes and adrenaline-fired reflexes matched my own. Like me, they were all running from something. They were all afraid of something that they couldn't really forget or confront. And only danger money, earned with reckless risk, helped them to escape for a few hours and to sleep. A second, third, and fourth trip to Africa followed without incident. I used 3 different passports, departing and arriving from different Indian international airports each time, and then taking domestic flights back to Bombay. The double shuffle flights between Delhi and Bombay continued. The specialist tasks that I performed with Khaled's currency dealers and some of the gold traders kept me busy. Busy enough most of the time. Not to think too long and too hard of Kala. Towards the end of the monsoon, I visited the slum and joined Kasim Ali on his daily tour of inspection. As he checked the drainage channels and ordered the repair of damaged huts, I recalled how much I'd admired and depended upon him when I'd lived there in the slum. Walking beside Kasim Ali, in my new boots and black jeans, I watched the strong young men in bare feet and lungis dig and scrape with their hands, as I'd once done. I watched them shore up the retaining walls and clear the clogged drains, ensuring that the slum would remain dry to the end of the rains. And I envied them. I envied the importance of the work and their earnest devotion to it. I'd known it once, so well, that fervent and unquestioning dedication. I'd earned the smiles of pride and gratitude from the slum dwellers when the dirty work was done. But that life was gone for me. Its virtues and its solaces beyond price were as remote and irrecoverable as the life I'd known and lost in Australia. Perhaps sensing my somber mood, Kasim directed us toward the open area where Prabhakar and Johnny were making the first preparations for their weddings. Johnny and a dozen or so of his neighbours were erecting the frame for a shamiana, or great tent, where the wedding ceremonies would take place. Some distance away, other men were building a small stage where the couples would sit after the ceremonies and receive gifts from family members and friends. Johnny greeted me warmly and explained that Prabhakar was working in his rented taxi and would return after sunset. Together we walked around the framed structure, examining the construction and discussing the relative merits and costs of a plastic or a cotton covering. Inviting me to drink tea, Johnny led us to the team of stage builders. My former neighbour, Jitendra, was the supervisor for the project. He seemed to have recovered from the grief that had enfeebled him for many months after his wife's death in the cholera epidemic. He wasn't so robust. The once familiar paunch had shrunk to a tight little mound beneath his t-shirt. But his eyes were bright with hope again, and his smile wasn't forced. His son, Satish, had grown in a rapid burst since his mother's death. When I shook hands with him, I passed a 100-rupee note in the press of hands. He accepted it just as secretively and slid it into the pocket of his shorts. The smile he gave me was warm, but he was still wounded by his mother's death. There was a hollowness in his eyes, a black hole of shocked grieving that swallowed all the questions and released no answers. When he returned to his work, cutting lengths of coconut fibre rope for the men to tie around bamboo bracing poles, his young face assumed a numb expression. I knew that expression. I sometimes caught it by chance in the mirror. The way we look when the part of happiness that's trusting and innocent is ripped away, and we blame ourselves, rightly or wrongly, for its loss.
"You know where I got my name?" Johnny asked me as we sipped hot, delicious slum chai.
"No," I answered, smiling to match the laughter in his eyes.
"You never told me." "I was born on the footpath near Crawford Market. My mother had a little place there, a little hut made with plastic and 2 poles.
The plastic was tied to a wall underneath a sign. The sign was all broken, you know, and only two bits